pleasure of to be here, and thank you for the organizers for giving me the opportunity to talk to so many people in physics about these works, which I'm sure are going to be this area is going to be is already exciting for physicists, and it's an area where clearly people with a background in physics can contribute much. I don't have a background in physics, so I will. If there is any notation which or anything I mention which is which I sort of assume that you know what it means, but it's completely don't know, it's not known, then it's probably there is a very simple explanation for it, so don't hesitate to ask. So I will talk about sequence and structure matching, and in particular about how one applies probability theory in this context, and it is based on a series of works with a few people who are mentioned here, two of my students, Stephen Jiang and Yanis Kontoyanis, and Sam Carlin and Ofer Zeituni, that range starting from the 90s and ending up just recently. And there will be about four subjects I will try to mention, depending on, you know, if there will be more questions, we may not get to the end, but I'll start with large exceedances and move to maximal non-aligned segmental score, approximate template matching, and local matching in structures. And hopefully by the end, all these buzzwords will make sense. So I will start with something which I think is simpler, which is large exceedances in sequence analysis. So here we are playing a game where we have just one sequence of letters. In the biological applications, there will be amino acids or bases, and they come at different frequencies, and since we don't know maybe in advance what they will be, or there is an ensemble of possible sequences, we will play the game of assuming that they are random variables, and there are some properties of the amino acids which we care about, and these will be marked by scores, the scores SJ, and the mathematical idealization of this procedure that you have a sequence of real-valued random variables. The real-valued random variable represents the value of the score assigned to the particular letter in the amino acid primary sequence. And we will assume some simple-minded probabilistic model for the behavior of this sequence. And the assumption we'll make, the simplest assumption, is that these variables are independent and have the same distribution, which is marked here by independent integral distributed, or IID. And what we'll do, we will try to look at statistic as a function of the sequence that measure certain rare unusual behavior, and we will try to use probability theory to provide a limit law under the assumption the sequence is pretty large. This assumption will simplify the mathematics, and then we will get a limit law for the probability of getting a certain value for our score statistic. And in experiment, people will run the score statistics on a particular sequence data, and they will compare to the probability that they get from the formula. And if it's much smaller than the probability they get in the formula, then maybe this sequence deserves further attention. If it is not much smaller, then they can explain this particular large value of the statistic as simply a coincidence due to random fluctuations that does not require further attention by somebody who understands the biology. So one should, of course, come up with a particular statistic, but one that was suggested, and is pretty common in the statistical area to deal with such problems, is to look at the maximal segmental score. So you are asking, you have a long sequence, and you are interested in a certain rare phenomena. For example, one example can be that the score can be the charge of the particular amino acid, and you are looking for an area which has a large positive charge or large negative charge, And suppose you want to allow positive charge, you just sum the charges along the sequence, but you don't want it to be diluted by having lots of stuff which is neutral, so you will run a window, slide a window along the sequence, and collect the sum of the scores in the window, and look for the maximum over all possible starting and ending points of the window. This is a way to look at neighborhood score. So the goal, from a mathematical point of view here, is to find the law, the limit law, of this score statistics Rn, which is just written here, which describes what I said. It's a maximum of the sum of the scores in a segment, when you run the segment, the initial and end point of the segment along the sequence. And we are assuming that the sequence length is much large, is quite large. And we would like to compute the law of Rn. Now, also in statistics, this is really what you will do. In terms of the mathematics, it is easier to describe the results by moving to a dual variable. In a dual variable, you imagine that the sequence is no longer finite, but rather infinite in length. And instead of looking for the maximum value you can get in a finite horizon n, you are looking for the first n for which the value will exceed a certain threshold y. And it's known in mathematics that you can easily convert the formulas from one to another, and simply the formula for ty will be easier than simpler to explain. So I will just write the formulas for ty, and I will do one transformation to show you that you can move back to the original. So before we continue, let me divert a little bit and mention, and this is a slide that you can sort of sleep through if you don't like it. Let's just mention that these kind of problems appear in different contexts, in contexts which are classical in probability theory or in application of probability to different sciences which have nothing to do with biology. So some of these statistics are particular to the biological application, but this one, the one I started with, is really quite common. And one example of it, in computer science, people might be interested, you have a sequence of binary bits, zeros and ones, and you're looking for what will be the longest stretch of ones in this sequence. And this corresponds to a case where the score is one when you get one, or minus infinity when you get zero. So when you sum, every zero will set your score to minus infinity, and you have to start all over again, and the maximum sum will simply give you the longest stretch of ones. And for this, there is a classical work in the 70s of Erdős and Reinye. This is really, as I said, longest stretch of heads in a collection of coin tossing.
Can you please repeat the definition of the dual variable?
The dual variable. I will actually even write it here on the blackboard. It's a minimum of all n's greater or equal to 1, say, such that Rn is greater or equal to y. The difference is Rn is a maximum of some quantity from 1 to n, which increases. Ty is looking for the first time that you reach the threshold. If we look at the picture, n, Rn is a monotone sequence. You just stretch here a level y, so this will be Ty. So one example is a special example is a coin tossing problem. Another example is if you analyze a queuing system where customers arrive to a queue, then there is a less trivial transformation which says that if you define as your score the difference between the service time and the inter-arrival time, then Rn, the quantity that I mentioned before, is the maximum waiting time among the first n customers. But I will not elaborate on this because transformation is non-trivial here. Another case in statistics where the transformation is easier to follow is in statistics there are problems called change point problems. These problems correspond to a situation where you collected an infinite, finite or long, or maybe infinite data sequence where you know that in the beginning the data behaves according to a certain random distribution, and then at some point there is an abrupt change in the behavior of your system, which you are not aware of, but you know it may come, and after this change, the distribution of the data is according to a different distribution. One example, you know, is maybe that this is only noise, happens and there is something happening and start to come a signal, and your job is to, as quickly as possible, detect the signal after the change have come. And one procedure that people like to do in statistics in such a case is they compute the log of the ratio of the probabilities of the data points. We are assuming that we know what are the probabilities before and after the change. We just don't know when is the change time. And they run a statistics like this RN statistics, which I mentioned, because they know that under P1, the log of P1 to P0 has a positive mean, and under P0 it has a negative mean. So the idea is that if you locate a segment where you have a large value of RN, you can look at the beginning point and it will indicate the change point. So people in statistics have studied the same statistic for a different perspective. So let me move back now to the issue at hand, and also to questions in biology. And so we are going to make some assumptions to make the problem reasonable or interesting. And the assumptions we want to make is, the first assumption we want to make is that the expected value of the score is negative. The reason for that is because we are interested in locating, remember what we, our original motivation, we're interested in locating an unlikely segment in a long sequence. So if the score has a negative mean, it means that most of the places will contribute a negative quantity. On the other hand, we really want the score to be able to detect the rare event. So we would like to be possible to get some positive numbers. So we would like it to be possible to get a positive score, but rather usual score is negative. This would mean that we can get actually very large values for this variable RN, but they will correspond to relatively small segments of this random sequence, which represent a rare event. And there is also some assumption about boundedness of the scores, but this assumption is really not completely restrictive in so far as the biology is concerned, because in the biology example we have only finitely many different letters, so we have only finitely many different scores, so definitely there is the largest one. So this is not really a big deal. And the theorem that was derived by Don Eigelhard in the context of Q-ring theory is giving you a distribution for the dual variable of this variable Rn, which says that this dual variable T of Y is behaving essentially like an exponential random variable. So the probability that it exceeds the threshold decays exponentially with the threshold, but there is also a scaling factor involving the level of Y. So let me try to explain the heuristic behind it, and in particular in this distribution you will have two parameters. One I mark by theta star, but in biology it's usually called lambda, and the other one I mark by k star, and usually called k. So there are two parameters here, one the scaling and the other one for the exponential distribution, and both of them are given explicitly. The first one is really very simple. Lambda is a place where the expected value of e to the theta x equal to 1. So you simply solve this equation, which in case of biological thing is just it's a finite equation with one nonlinear equation with one unknown, and you solve it numerically to get the value of theta. The parameter k is much more complicated to actually get numerically, but it is given explicitly by some huge formula, which I don't want to write. Instead, I want to explain why this theorem is correct, and also I want to show you how it relates to Rn. So I remind you that Rn, if Rn is equal to Y, is the same as Ty is equal to N. What is this picture? Roughly. We ignore the small changes over the threshold, so it will make the things deriving simple. Now we know we are looking at Ty equal T E to the theta star Y. So this is the same as N equal T E to the theta star Rn. I just replace Ty by N and Y by Rn. So this is the same as Rn, I take a log, minus, maybe I'll do it slowly, it's better for you, log T equal log N, or Rn minus 1 over theta star log n is equal to minus, is equal to plus x, or x is log t. And we know that the probability of this event should be equal e to the minus k star t. I have a mistake here. So if we have this x is 1 over theta star log t, which I get by dividing by theta star and moving this stuff to the other side. There is a minus sign. So it's minus 1 over theta star log t, then t is e to the minus theta star x. So what we get is p rn minus 1 over theta star log n, having something to do with x, is going to be approximately e to the minus k star, e to the minus theta star x. And we just have to decide about what is the correct order inequality, and I think it should be less. And the way to check it is simply you send x to infinity, this is equal to 1. When I send x to infinity, this will go to 0, e to the 0 will go to 1. So it's a sign that I got the inequality correctly. Otherwise, I reverse it. And this is actually a theorem. So if n goes to infinity, this is a theorem. And it is exactly coming from the previous theorem I gave you, and the only thing you need to justify that you can actually write these equalities, but more or less it's exactly what I did here, plus information that you don't exceed the thresholds by much. Now, this is what is called sometimes Gumbel distribution. Gumbel, I think you write it with E before there. I'm not sure. But in any case, you have a Gumbel distribution for this Rn, it corresponding to having an exponential distribution for Ty. And the heuristic for why we have exponential distribution for Ty is much easier for me to explain. And also, it's shorter to write. You see that here I have two exponents, and so it's longer on a slide. That's another excuse. Okay, so let me try to I lost my slide of explanation. Okay, doesn't matter. I remember.
Where did you get this?
Yes.
Probability of this expression is exponentially distributed.
This I got by saying there is a theorem that Eigenhardt proved. And I'm going to explain now the heuristic behind this theorem. This is exactly this theorem which I quoted before. Okay? So I had a theorem which I quoted but did not explain why it is true. And then I explained why this theorem is relevant to the question I started with. So now I'm coming back to this theorem and trying to explain what is the reason for this to be true. The explanation will be approximate. So the explanation is really very simple. You have your sequence. You have your sequence. This is 1 to n. And you are trying to exceed the threshold y. To exceed the threshold y, you would need you have a probability of success in exceeding this threshold if you start at a particular location. Let's call it P of Y. This will be the probability, this is a probability of finding a sum of Xi that exceeds Y. But now we start at just 1. We just start at 1 and we go up to some number L and we can take the maximum over L. So we are allowing ourselves to take a sum of n as long as we want or as short as we want, trying to exceed y. But we are not allowed now. We're playing the game. We are not allowed to move the starting point. And it happens to be that there is some links which will be typically the one that will give the larger sum. But it's not very long, because if you take extremely long sum, what will happen, you will kick up this ergodic theory. So the sum of xi will be approximately the size L times the expected value. So it's negative. So this is not going to give us much good. On the other hand, if you start with just 1x, we will not exceed the value y. So we will need of order y things to exceed this value. Now, this P of y is going to be exponential e to the minus theta star y, and it's going to be some constant in front of it. So this is roughly what is going to be the probability of success when we fix the starting point. And as I said, it really, we don't need to look at all L's, we can stop at some point. We don't need to look at all the L's. Now, we can now move the starting point. We can move it to 2, and we can move it to 3, and we can try all sorts of different starting points. If we move the starting point completely to a new place, a place which was not covered by the sequence we considered before, then we get a completely independent attempt. So we can think of, if we ignore the overlap, we can think of attempting at 1, then attempting at some number k, at some number, some number n1, 2n1, and so on. Okay, so we can make independent attempts. Now, if we are making independent attempts, because they involve different pieces of the sequence, and each one of them has a probability py of success, what will happen is that time until the first success, which is a random variable ty, will have a geometric distribution. This is just basic probability theory. And since the numbers here are not exactly discrete, it will become in the limit exponential, which is the same as geometric, except that you don't care about the discreteness. So we will have an exponential distribution, and what will matter for the exponential distribution will be 1, will be this guy, because the number that will take us to succeed. So here, okay, have a choke. So we are looking at a long sequence, and we imagine that we are making independent attempts. We are now ignoring the fact that we are taking also pieces which overlap. So if we take here kt over py, this is a length, maybe t over, the length here is let's take a length which is t over py, maybe at over py. We take a length which is at over py, and we have here attempts which last about a. So what will happen is that the probability of no success is 1 minus the probability of success, so we have to fail, and we have to fail in this number of attempts. So if py is small, then this is roughly going to be e to the minus a t. And so we will have p of ty greater or equal t times a divided by c times e to the theta star y, because p of y, as I wrote here on the slide, is approximately c times e to the minus theta y, is going to be roughly e to the minus a t. So now you just need to set a equal c equal k. And what you will get? You will get the limit distribution that I wrote to you.
What is exactly
at
over py?
I'm imagining a game in which I have successes happening with probability py, and I'm trying afresh after a steps, and I'm setting the length of the sequence to some number. And to make my life nice, I set the length of the sequence to be a t over py.
I'm sorry.
The length of the sequence, the length of the sequence in letters is a t over py, n if you want.
I'm sorry, but the people sitting on this side
cannot see. Okay. So maybe I will write it on the slides. I will write it here.
Yes.
Okay.
Maybe take out the screen.
but I will need it again. So I can continue writing on the screen. That's okay.
No, this is worse. It's worse because you're just iPhone.
This is what's
a complicated
problem.
Just
turn off the wall. Better to remove the screen.
Better to remove the screen light on the wall. Okay. Okay. So now you can see to here, or I should write from in the center?
I'm a little bit confused. Can I just go back and ask? So the
yes.
X is a bunch of numbers, and most of them are negative, right?
Yes.
And sometimes it's a positive one. So you want
right.
sum to be greater than Y. That's what you're asking.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
So you divide it into little segments.
So I divide into little segments, which is what I did here. And I'm assuming in the real statistics you actually sum over these, and then you move one, you sum over these, and you have a freedom of the initial point and the end point.
Right.
And what I'm saying is, first of all, the freedom in the end point is all taken care into through this PY. This PY is already capturing the maximum you can get when you fix the initial point and let your sum. And I mentioned that, by the way, that you will not really use a very large piece, but you will also not use a very small piece.
Mm-hmm.
So PY is a probability that the maximum of the sum of XI from I equal 1 to L and the maximum over L is greater or equal to Y. And I remark that the L, good L's,
mm-hmm.
are of order of Y. Because all the xi's are finite,
mm-hmm.
so you cannot really get to y with one huge jump.
Right.
And on the other hand, if you try to make l extremely large, the ergodic theory will kick in and tell you to go home. So we must do it like this. But since the expected value is negative, it happens that this probability will actually be exponentially small in terms of y, with some coefficient theta.
What does it mean it happens?
Sorry?
What do you mean it happens? I mean
that if you analyze, you can say, okay, instead of maximum from L equal greater or equal to 1, let's study the sum for fixed L and see what is the probability as a function of L. And what we will see is the probability will be 0 until we reach a certain L, which is at least Y divided by a constant. Then it is still small, but it will sort of grow. And then when L becomes really large, it will be so small that so far as we are concerned, we just need to look at these L's. Most of the probability is here. We can restrict the L's here and get the same
right.
C times little minus.
So you have to exclude the expectation value equal to 0, otherwise you have a...
Yes, you have to. I said expectation value is negative.
Negative.
That's important. If expectation is 0, the whole
yes.
picture is different.
Because it's square root?
Or? Yes. The whole picture is different.
Right. And the A, you're taking somehow a quarter L? Or?
No. So this was just sort of a warm-up idea. Now I need to deal with the fact that I'm actually moving both endpoints. So I'm making the following simplifying approximation to say, well, I don't really need to move every step. In some sense, the answer will be about the same, and this has to be justified, and there is some non-trivial mathematics in justifying it, but I will hide it under the carpet, and instead I just imagine that I just move A a time, and I'm making trials of size A. So A, in this picture, A will be of order of Y, if you want to be exact, but then it will be completely wrong. So maybe it's better that we imagine that A is finite, although it's not true. So I'm cheating, okay? So once I say I'm cheating, so this is fine. I'm cheating, and then we can continue. So I'm imagining that I can make attempts which are independent just in order to explain why we get the exponential distribution. So we are making independent attempts. Each one of them lasts about size A, so we skip. And we set the lengths of the whole sequence. We have a freedom in the lengths. This is actually the variable ty. So I decided to set it to be proportional to 1 over py with some proportionality constant, which I called a times t.
But shouldn't that be a squared then? I mean, you total length a t over py, so the independent segment should be that divided by a, so you shouldn't raise to the power of a t over py.
Ah, this should be, yeah. I made a mistake. Right, so this should be divided by Okay, so I take
and
AT.
Then
you get e to the
minus. Right, then you don't get the A. AT, so I get here to T, so I get e to the minus, e to the, no, so I don't want T, I want actually T here. I want the parameter left at the end. So I can set this to T, I can set this to T, CT, CT, and then I will have A. Okay, let me see. If I set this to CT, this will be exactly what I want. And I will have here a C over A PY, because each of them takes length A, and I have CT over PY length in letters. So the length in trial is CT over A PY. The one over PY, they cancel the e to the minus, the one minus, this is just one minus x to the power one over x is e to the minus one, and I will be left with C over A. So I should set K. K to be C over A. But as I said, since I am cheating anyway, it really doesn't matter much. What it matters is that I'm trying to explain where is the, what is the origin for the constant K. So I'm saying the constant K has really two origins. One origin comes from the pre-exponent in the computation of PY, which is not exactly exponential but has a pre-multiplier. And the second origin is in the fact that we don't really try every step, but we really effectively try every A steps. And when you take the ratio of these two quantities, you get another quantity which is called K. Now, what I was doing, I was cheating because this A, which I'm using here, is supposed to be finite. A does not depend on Y. But if I want to make them completely independent, I'm sort of forced to use as A the order of the typical L, which is order of Y. So I will not manage to get alive if I try to do it correctly. So that's why I'm saying I was cheating, because really these are not independent. But the point is that what happens, there is something called a fluctuation theory, which is much more complicated, that says that if you try every time again, the effect of it is that if you are trying independently with distance A, insofar as this exponential behavior is concerned, but to justify it is not, mathematically, is beyond just easy hand waving, it's hard hand waving. I'm not going to get into it because it's just very technical. This is illustrative enough. It says that there are two constants, theta and lambda and k. Lambda comes from the exponent in the exponential decay of the probability. The role of k is coming from two things. One is a correction to the probability, and the other thing is the effect of what is the effective number of letters you have to move in order to imagine that you are starting with an independent trial. And you get the ratio of these two constants. And you also saw why you have the exponential as a result of this 1 minus p to the 1 over the number, to the number of times. This gives rise to the exponential. When you make the exponential with this dual variable, you get the gamble. So I was trying to eliminate number of mysteries here.
I understand the A part, but the C is how do the why does this two C are the same? The C here and the CT or P, what? Where did that come from?
Because I wanted to get this guy, right? So I actually had C. I actually have this is one over P Y. Right? And I multiply by C, so I would cancel it. If at the end, you know, just the way I wrote the formula, I want T e to the theta y. I did not care about the py. Since the py has a correction term, I divide and multiply by it, so this will be 1 over p, which will get rid with this guy, but then I need an extra pc, which means that I'm... This is just because of the way we write this. So we just simplify. When you see the answer, you don't want it, it's like a machine. You want it to run, you don't want to see the pieces. So you don't want to see the C in the answer formula, so we canceled it. I could have kept the C, I could have written it like this, it's exactly the same. This will be exactly the same, I just changed the letter T. But here you have three constants. So any clever person will say, I can move it here and make it with two constants. you know, and if you actually, you know, another thing, if you know that you have this distribution, sometimes you know you have a distribution, but you don't know what the numbers are. The constant k can be complicated, but if you know that it has this distribution, you may simply try to get it from Monte Carlo simulation or some other numerical method. And then you want to minimize the number of constants, you have to estimate numerically, if you don't have an analytic form. But the point is that this idea works for all sorts of different maxima over random segments or random structures, that you will look at the dual variable, and because of these independent attempts, you get the exponential, and when you transform, you get the Gamble distribution. This is called in probability theory extreme value theory. And this is a very simple, relatively simple special case.
Excuse yes. me,
one question, I mean, the theory that you are not explaining, it gives a value, it proves that this constant k exists, that a is finite.
Everything can be done rigorously, but yeah, it takes more blackboard. The theory gives a formula for C and a formula for A and proves that this result is true. The question is, what do you call a formula? I mean, it's a formula, but it's not a formula. The formula for theta star is you solve this theta star. Okay, this is what I call a nice formula. And you can imagine that since I didn't write the formula for K star, it's not as simple. The formula for K star may involve the probability that SK is greater or equal, let's say, zero for all K, and you have to do some computation over these things. So you have to compute all these probabilities, and when you massage them, you get this guy. So it's a formula, but unless it's a very simple cases, it will be difficult it's a function of all these guys. Not one. One will not frighten you. But it's a function of all these guys, so it can be quite complicated to do it on a computer, but it's a function of the type of a series expansion, and then you can do approximation by it's somewhat manageable, but definitely not something you want to write on a slide if you have a small slide. It's a complicated formula, but it's a formula. Yes.
Can you extend this theory to the case of the zero expectation value?
You can, and I actually have it on the slide, so we can continue now. Good. So we can now continue. Okay. And talk about extensions. Okay. So first of all, the same theory applies. The fact that you have independent letters is not that crucial. You can take Markov letters which come from a Markov chain, where you have dependence between the letter and the next letter. And if you want to ask why we care about Markov letters, this is what happened if you take a score which depends on pairs of letters. If the score depends on pairs of letters, even if you want to assume the letters are independent, the scores must be dependent because you use the same letter for this score and this score. So if your score already is a score about pairs, you won't say two consecutive amino acids that are charged or something more complicated than that, then you get the Markov dependence and the same will apply. There are other applications to other fields of statistics, which I mentioned here, but maybe you don't care about it that much. And here is this beware, which applies to the question I was asked. If you have zero mean, then you can derive the results, but they will be different. What will happen is either you have to take zero mean, or you may look for the maximum. Instead of looking for a segment of maximum score, you can look for a longer segment of positive score. That's another way. There are two ways to characterize randomness. One is to look for the largest score. The other one is just to look for a longest positive score. They will give different growth rate. In particular, if you take the case of zero mean, you actually have a different situation because it's much less rare. If it's zero mean, it's much less rare to get a large score, and in particular you will no longer have this exponential distribution. Distribution will be much more complicated, reflecting the fact that your actual attempt will take much more factor of n. If you look at, as we did this computation with the TY, remember that the value of Rn that we get in the negative mean is of order log n. So the length of the segment that achieves this high score is log n, which is large compared to 1, but much smaller compared to n. In the case of 0 mean, the segment that achieves the maximum will be of order square root of n. It will reflect more like fluctuations of Brownian motion or regular random walk. So it, in some sense, it is easier because you can, in the case of 0 mean, use a theory of Brownian motion. So you can use a classical thing that sums of discrete things converge to random continuous process, and you can use it. But on the other hand, it's a little bit more complicated because you no longer have this exponential, because you can no longer say that you can imagine that you have this sequence of independent trials. So you get a rather complicated distribution. I think it's a Leffler of order half or so. It's a, the Laplace transform, it's a distribution whose Fourier transform is involving sine hyperbolic or something. So you can get a formula for this, but it's much less interesting. Also, as far as I know, it's of much less interest in biology. And the reason for that, as Sam Carlin put it to me so eloquently, he said, okay, if I take a matrix of scores, why should the mean be zero? It will be a number, and unless I do it very precisely to create zero mean, it will create some negative mean. So the only reason you have zero mean is if there is some, in physics you often have zero mean, because there is some mechanism in life that makes it zero mean. If the people are choosing it, unless they deliberately choose it in such a way that they will get zero mean, they will not get zero mean. Now, when you study with probability theory such large exceedances, not only do you get, when you do all the proofs, not only do you get the value of the score Rn, but as a by-process of the whole procedure, you can also get understanding to what will be the value of the score in the segment which achieves a large value. And this is rather maybe rather confusing, but I think not so confusing to physicists, which are very used to it, that when you are looking at something which is rare, the law is changed. Well, that's the same as if you do in statistical mechanics. When you put an Hamiltonian, after the interaction, you are no longer having your prior non-interacting measure. So the same happens here. When you look at the segment which achieves a large score, it is of itself long. It's much smaller than n, but it has a log n length, so if n is very large, it itself is also large. So there is some averaging procedure happening there, but it's not according to the original distribution, it's according to a new distribution which has a positive, at least a positive value of the score, otherwise you would not get the average. And there is actually a characterization of this distribution which is given by, this is the ratio between this distribution and the original one, is e to the theta star x. So this is very reminiscent of the concept of Gibbs measures in statistical physics. It's I could say a degenerate case of this. So in particular, you actually are going to know, if everything was random, you know what will be the composition of the letters in this rare sequence. And you can use it now and reverse the whole game and say, I don't know what scores to set. So one way to set the scores is by using this target distribution. This was suggested as a way to set metric scores by Carlin and Altschul in 1990 when we had this analysis done. So based on the analysis, said, okay, if you want certain target frequencies, if your goal is to look for segments where the frequency of the amino acids or the bases is not the original frequency P, but rather a different frequency P star, set your score to be the log of the ratio between P star to P divided by theta star, because then in the random, what you will get is exactly the target distribution. So that's one way to create a metric score. So one of the classes of metric scores is, I think it's a Blossom one, is constructed. Blossom or
Pen.
Pen. Second one. One of the two conventional metrics score systems is using target frequencies and takes a log of the ratio of the target frequencies. So sometimes you can use a probability in reverse order and feed it back into the application area to set the scores. But in general, the idea of using scores in biology is to put a wall between the analyst and the experimentalist. So the experimentalist can bring a matrix of scores that fits a particular question that they want to do, and you can analyze a relatively general flexible scheme without the need to deal with the particulars of using this matrix score or that matrix score. So one of the reasons was to sort of divide, so you can analyze a whole collection of procedures that can be used for different purposes by different people. And that's common also in statistics, that you try to put a divider and say, you set the parameters here and I will set the parameters here. Okay, so this is, like I said, the biomolecular sequence application. This is used in, these formulas are used in setting the p-values in the BLAST program, which I think Stephen mentioned, talked in detail or not. Okay. So the next question is the question of sequence alignment. This is, I think, a workshop on sequence alignment, not about finding rare things in sequence. So here we have a very similar situation mathematically, although not very similar biologically. We are facing here two sequences. We can set more than two, but two will be enough for examination. So we have two sequences of letters, A's and B's, I will call them. And I will again assume under the random model that the A's and the B's are both independent and identically distributed random variables. So we have letters, but we don't know in advance which they are because we have an ensemble of sequences. And we want to check whether the sequences A and B are really independent or not. Well, that's really what we are trying. So we are trying to see if there is an area from the biology point of view, if there is an area in the two sequences which is too much in common, way too much in common compared to the assumption that they have nothing to do with each other. If there is an area which is too much in common and we know what it is doing in B, then the biologist can say, well, maybe it's doing the same in A. That's sort of the idea insofar as the biology is concerned. If you try to bring it into, again, mathematical idealization, what we will do, we will give a score, F, which will assign a real valued number to a pair of letters. The simple case of a score can be 1 when they match and -5 when they don't match. Okay? So this will be one example. If you know that there are certain substitutions between amino acids that are more frequent than others, you can make a much better choice by putting very negative numbers between pairs which are not supposed to be substituted for each other and relatively small negative numbers when they are when they are easily substituted, or maybe you want to check only matches between a certain group of amino acids ignoring other groups. You can set the scores the way you like, and once somebody else sets a score, you can analyze it. So again, we put the wall, somebody setting the scores, and you analyze it later. So we have the scores, and one possible way to match pieces is to simply, again, slide the window over the first sequence, slide the window over the second sequence, and look for every starting point in both sequences. You match them against each other, sum the scores, and look for the maximum over all possible starting point in first sequence, starting point in second sequence, and the length of the window. So we have three parameters, I, J, and delta. I, J are the starting points, and delta is the length. And again, how will you use probability theory? We will try, assuming that the length of the sequence N is very large, to find the limit law for the probability that Mn exceeds a large value. And then, in experiment, we will run the experiment over a pair of sequences, get a value of Mn that correspond to a certain locations ij and certain lengths delta. If this value is similar to the value we get from the theory, then we may discard this segment. If the value is much larger than the value of the theory, suggesting that under the hypothesis of having independence, this is rather unlikely to happen, the biologist can pass it to a second test and actually look at it and try to understand what it means. So it's really a way to reorder the results of the experiments. So if we go back to the mathematics, our goal is to find the law of Mn, again assuming that n is much larger than 1. Now in typical sequences, the length is few hundreds, and this is approximately the same as infinity for such theories, because It's reasonably large. And again, to explain, it will be easier to move to the random variable ty, which is a dual variable. The same procedure I did before. If I show you that ty is exponential, mn will become gamble. Okay, so the claim is that under reasonable assumptions, indeed the heuristic that we apply to R, to one sequence, will apply to two sequences. So let me state what the result is and what are the assumptions. And then I will erase I will raise a screen and try to explain why it is true. So we are making similar assumptions to the assumptions we made before. We would like having a matching segment to be a rare event. So we don't want everything to match, so we set the expectation of the matching scores to be less than zero. This means that you are more often going to pay for mismatch than to get a value for match, because otherwise the whole sequence will contribute and it will be not what you are looking for. But we really want a possibility for positive match. So the classical example of having match giving you score 1 and mismatch giving you score minus infinity, which is where you look for perfect match, is definitely falling under these two assumptions. And we also want the score again to be bounded, so you will not be able to achieve a huge score just with one letter, which again is reasonable if you have a finite alphabet. Now we need some extra conditions, which I will explain in a minute. In principle, it will be easiest to explain it if both sequences have the same distribution of letters. So the distribution of letters in the first sequence is the same as distribution of letters in the second sequence, and the score is symmetric. This is one possible case. If your two sequences come from the same family of stuff, you would expect to have about the same frequency, and there is no reason in the score to make it anti-symmetric. There is no reason to look more in one than in the other. There are situations where you actually want to deviate from this assumption, and I will talk about them later. So if you are in this position, there are these theta star and k star from the previous story. Okay? Theta star is the one where e to the e theta star f is 1, and k star is the same from the previous story, which I did not want to write the formula, so I adhere to it here again, where you replace sync of f of a and b as your variable x. So you look at a has a distribution, b has a distribution, together they have a joint distribution, you compute f, this becomes a real valued random variable x, and you are defining that k star that correspond to x. So then the formula is that up to taking a square root here, up to taking a square root on ty, you get exactly the same result as what you got before. So before we had a limit theorem p of ty greater or equal t times e to the theta star y was exponential with parameter k star, what we need to do is simply take the square root of what is sitting here. Okay? And the intuition to this is the same as saying the following rather outrageous a priori, but correct a posteriori statement, that mn is the same as rn square. Okay? Two sequences of size n are equivalent, morally, to one sequence of size n square. And if you follow this principle, then all you need to do is to change every n you find to n square, and that's exactly the same in the dual as changing this to a square root and leaving everything else the same. We can go over the computation if you want. Okay, so so maybe I'll stop here and go to the blackboard. So now we have our two sequences, here they are. And what we are doing, remember, we are sliding a window on this one and we are sliding a window on this one, and then we are making a mesh, let's say here, and at some point we take a different pair and try to match it, let's say here. So this is one possibility, this is another possibility, and we have all those different possibilities, and we have about n letters here and n letters here. So if you ignore, we should ignore the length, because as we said, there is, although we have a free parameter in the lengths, very short lengths are not going to help us, and very long lengths are not going to help us, so we're not going to be rescued by the lengths. However, these two parameters are going to help us. So we have n choices for this guy, and n choices for this guy. How many choices do we have together? We have n squared choices for ij. Now, once we set I and J, we can try sliding this, and we have exactly the same problem as we had before, where the F is replacing the X. Because now we set the beginning and the end, and we simply, we always take this guy with this guy, and then this guy with this guy, and so on and so forth. So, per choice, we do max sum xi n where x is f a b. So this indeed will be c e to the minus theta star y. So there's no dispute about this, because it's the same as what we had before. And effectively, once I minus J is set, every A start in U. So what I'm doing, instead of setting I and J, I'm setting just the difference between them. So I'm setting the angle, if you want, on this diagram. And then I'm saying, okay, on one hand I have this sum over the window size. This is already reflecting what I did before. But also, if I move both of them a little bit, it's also reflected by what I did here. And I told you that this fluctuation theory is telling you that actually, although you are running every one, and they are independent of each other, it has the same effect insofar as the limit is concerned as jumping every A and assuming that they are independent. So, except for these different angles, the problem here is exactly the same as the problem before. So if we fix the angle, it's exactly the same problem. Of course, if the angle is too long, you actually lose some in the lengths. But we're assuming the angle is relatively small. Okay. But I minus J has n choices. And what happened is, although you have only 2n letters, and you are reusing the same 2n letters, let's see what happened if you compare this choice, where the angle is 0, and let me take in a different color, angle of 1. So you see, I'm actually using the same pairs, in the same letters. In the previous one, I take A1 and I match it to B1. And then A2 and match it to B2. So I have F A1 B1 plus F A2 B2 and so on. And in the yellow one, I have F A1 B2 plus F A2 B3 and so on. So if you look at it in the beginning, you may say, well, these two are very dependent because you use the same letters. But the point is that this function f is non-linear. So f of a1, b1 behaves as if it's independent of f of a1, b2, roughly. Or independent enough. Because these two letters are independent, and it's not linear. So just adding one variable which is different sort of makes it completely different as far as the outcome is concerned. So we can assume, and we should have to prove it, if you actually want to do it rigorously, that can treat different angles as independent trials. And once you justify such a statement, then you are in the position I said, that Mn is the same as Rn squared, because each one of them is an Rn, and then we have n independent attempts. Yes?
How non-linear does this function have to be?
It has to be non-linear.
Yeah.
Just non-linear. If it's linear, it's bad. You can see it's bad.
You say you have to assume the angle is smaller if you use that?
And I have to assume that the, I have, well, because the length here is, okay, I actually don't have to assume the angle is small, but I have to do some, the problem is if you, depends how you define an angle. If I fix, if the angle is very long, it seems that this is becoming short.
Uh-huh.
But then I imagine that everything is wrapped around on a circle, so I'm not losing anything. Because I'm supposed also to take this negative angle. So it will be part of this angle. Imagine two circles and then you run, this will give you exactly n. Either you have exactly n choices, all of them have the same length, so you can have two n choices, but then they have different lengths. So it's easier to explain. Imagine that they are in a circle, and you have n choices, but this means that, for example, I'm taking this as a segment, but there is not a lot of loss here, because as we said, all the segments which are relevant are of size log n.
Mm-hmm.
So how many log n's you, I mean, there will be very little log n's on a circle of size n which wrap around.
Excuse me, you took letters A's and B's, right?
Yes.
How do you define linearity or non-linearity on such functions?
This is what I call non-linear.
Oh,
non-additive. Maybe I should have... non-additive. Yes, okay. I think of any function of B as B. But the question is how the A and B interact. Here they interact in a linear way, that you do something on A, do something on B, and add it up. Because if you add it up, you can say, wait a minute, you are just cheating. What you are doing a score on one letter, and a score on this sequence, and just add them up. So where do you get N squared? You have N and N. It's 2N. N plus N is 2N. It's definitely not N squared. So we are assuming this, and we also, as I said, assumed that PA is the same as PB. And let me explain to you why this assumption is in some sense crucial. Here is an example. Maybe B is always zero. There's only one letter in B. Okay. So of course, I can write a fancy score F of A and B, but you all know that there will be zero here. Anyway, so it's really just a score of A. So it cannot be of N squared, because although I put here N different zeros, I could erase them just as well, and no, nothing will happen. So this is, of course, an extreme trivial situation, but it reflects something. It reflects the fact that there are three competing difficulties here. One difficulty is in getting this match to work, that the A's are near the B's in the sense that they give you a good score F. Another difficulty is simply to get the A's you want in the top, and another difficulty is simply to get the B's you want in the top, in the bottom. Now, if A's are equal to B, in law, you can show that the difficulty of the joint, of the combination, is really the meaningful one. If, for example, one of the sequences is just having one letter, then it's obvious that the other sequence is what dominates. So what will happen if you look at, if you think of PA, PB, think of, and it's really like a plot. I mean, this is really a vector, usually not one number, but think of it as space and a space. In the diagonal, theory applies. It does not apply here. It does not apply here. And if you want to be correct, it will apply somewhere here. We can actually check. There are some conditions where the theory applies, which include the diagonal, but a little bit more, or maybe a lot more than the diagonal. But it will not apply near the boundaries where they are very different.
Is there any more precise?
Yes, there is a precise condition.
Okay, because Stephen Alshu was telling us the other day that he's using different frequencies for the different PAPDs for the two.
Yes, there is a precise condition, and if you actually look at the right picture should probably be looking like this. So I did not hear people complain that this is very small. But it's not containing the extremes. That's what I was This is what I want to say. It does not contain the extremes. In the extremes, like here, you can actually figure out what is going on. In the middle, which is very big, what is going on is what I explained. In between, what is going on is not so known. It's probably much more complicated than either of them. So nobody bothered, as far as I know, to analyze it.
This is for IID sequence.
This is for IID sequence.
Now, just sort of take a case not so extreme as an example. If I have a sequence that's sort of, it's very puppy, so lots of ones, lots of zeros, are you getting a problem?
Well, I don't, first of all, I had better have a sequence for which I can do the Rn. So I cannot take an arbitrary law, but we can take, for example, a Markov chain. So for a Markov chain, what I know what is happening in the Rn, so I can actually write the condition that I think is going to be the condition that will define this in the Markov chain. It will have the same picture, but the people didn't, nobody, as far as I know, I didn't bother to prove it. Also, I strongly believe that what I can write in a minute notice will be correct. If you want, I can write you the condition. It's actually not very difficult. What you do, remember the business with the target frequency is P star. What we know already, based on the one sequence theory, that the segment that will be relevant for us will have a P star, is a distribution of AB pairs, in the good matching segment. And I want to stress that P star is not a product measure. Also, originally, we have P star of AB is PA of A, PB of B, but then it has this e to the theta star FAB. It's really like physics. This is the interaction term, and it brings an interaction under the P star measure. Now, we check what is the entropy of P star with respect to P. P is PA cross PB. And we compare it to the entropy of P star A with respect to PA, and the entropy of P star B with respect to PB. And we divide this to a half. And why do we divide the entropy of the joint to a half? Because for the joint, we have n square options. And we compare these three. And one of them must be minimal. And in the case where this is the smallest, we are in good shape. That's this guy. In the case that these two, one of these two is the smallest, then is smallest or largest? Largest. Largest? No. So we divide this by half. I have to set the halves and look for large. Right, we look for what will be harder to do, right? We are looking at what will be harder to do. Large entropy is hard to do, not small entropy. This is not the entropy sum P. This is relative entropy. H Q to P is the sum QI log QI over PI. It's a distance, Kullback. In statistics, it's called Kullback-Leibler distance. In physics, maybe it's called relative entropy. In mathematics, it's called relative entropy. So it measures the distance between Q and P. So the harder it is, it means the harder it is to find P star if you start with letters which are P. So we compare the hardness of finding P star to P to the hardness of finding only the marginals. Now, of course, this is easier than this guy. So what do we do again? So this is, of course, smaller. So I put the halves originally correctly. I just look for the maximum, not the minimum. So I look for the maximum of these three. And if the maximum happened to be this guy, we are here. This is the definition of this region, is exactly what I just said. And the explanation is, as I said, the difficulty of finding a segment of size k of type P star, if you start with P, is e to the minus k is the relative entropy. and you compare it to n squared. So you compare, write n squared p to the minus kh p star p, and you compare it to 1. This will tell you how long is such a segment you can find, and you compare it to n e to the minus kh p star a to p a, and the same with the b. And each of them will give you a bound on the size k you can find. And the maximum will give you the maximum will tell you the real bound. And the question is, which of the three constraints is going to determine the length of the segment? If the constraint of the joint, then all the analysis I did here is correct. If the constraint is for one of them, then of course it's ridiculous.
So your p star is basically your p star ab sum over b.
Yes, yes. I forgot to say this. Yes. So p star a is sum p star ab over b. And it's because of this extra interaction term that it's not that it's more complicated. I mean, that it's not p of a. Oh, we have music.
To enhance the seminar.
Okay. Now, if you actually go over the details of doing it, it is actually quite a mess compared to the previous one. And it's quite a mess because of all these angles which use the same letters, and you have to somehow argue that it doesn't return nevertheless. And you have to look at all sorts of different pairs of angles you have to analyze. Now, here comes actually something which is good to know, which is called Poisson approximation. And this is the following heuristic observation. So previously, we were just sort of focused on the problem of finding one good match or one long sequence. We were never asking ourselves how many we have. We just said, do we have or not? But we can ask a more general question. Start in the first sequence, say at length t e to the theta star y. What will be the law of the number of segments which will achieve a value at least y? Maybe it's 0, maybe it's 1, maybe it's 2, there can be different numbers. Now, the exponential distribution for the probability of not finding anything goes very nicely with the Poisson distribution for the number of things you find. And this is sort of a general heuristic principle in probability. And there are quite well-developed procedures for finding when a counting variable is close to a Poisson random variable. This is called Poisson approximation. This phenomenon, the random variable of the counting type, approach Poisson when each probability is very small and there is a lot of them, is very common in probability theory. So people worked hard to derive a machinery for such things, and they have a very well-developed machinery. And actually the way to prove what I stated is not using this heuristic, but rather by counting how many pairs, endpoints I and j you will find, which will have a large value. If you can prove that the number of pairs is Poisson, then it will mean that the probability that we have none of them is e to the minus the parameter of the Poisson, and this will immediately get you the result. So a different way to say it is what I said here, is that what you do, you count the number of segment pairs ij, which will achieve at some length l, a score at least y, until when you go over a fixed horizon of square root of t to the theta star y over 2, and you show that this is Poisson. And if this is Poisson with this parameter, it will immediately give you this result, because this is a probability that you have zero count. When you found nothing until this time is the same as having zero in your count, and this is e to the minus the parameter of the Poisson. And the reason that this behavior is Poisson is because usually you have Poisson behavior when a success does not imply immediately a success in the immediate neighborhood. So we have events over a large horizon, we have a lot of range for I and J. We know that the probability is very small. This we already computed for one particular event. We only need to check that when we have a success, it does not imply a success in the immediate neighborhood. So So what we need to check, we need to actually examine a success for particular I and j. Does it mean, what is the point? It means a success for very close angle. So we use the same letters. So we have to analyze what I just told you, that if we move the angle even by one, it ruins somehow the order. And that's where we use the non-additivity of the scope.
Do you agree that Black is right under condition or
no? Yes, for the proof. Yeah, nobody is doing it in biological experiment, but proof you can, in proof you can... Let me explain, you analyze the procedure. The procedure can be clever. Sometimes it's much easier to analyze a much dumber procedure because the mathematics is nicer and you show that they have the same limits. And that's what we do. So we analyze with periodic boundary conditions. It's just simpler, but of course it's not helping anybody if you actually do it.
You think another elastic sequence there going this way and back to the other part of the lattice, right?
Yeah.
So
what you do, you actually imagine, as I said, we actually imagine that they are sitting on a that the letters are sitting on a circle, and you just put the window here, and then you have another circle and you put the window here. And if you actually have a real sequence, what it means that we take the last letter and think of creating a segment involving the last letters and the first letters. And you can object that this is really ridiculous, but what I'm saying, there aren't that many. Anyway, the segments we are considering are of order log n. So there are quite a few that we will create additional dumb segments, and the chance that just these particular dumb segments are going to give you the value is very small, because it's just according to their number. There is no reason why these guys will give you the score and not the ones in the middle. So the error you create in terms of probability is very small.
It is proved or it's assumed?
No, everything is proved. This is not like a boundary conditions of an easing model or something else, where boundary conditions could be a big effect.
You just redundantly put two halves in the sequence along each side. Similar to that. And then you just look for...
Yes. But this looks really bad. But I'm just saying that when you do redundantly put... the amount you add is only at the boundary, because at some point you just repeat what you did before. There is no.
And you look for signals within that square, basically.
Yeah.
That's very.
What?
Yeah.
No, but the way I see. No, think of it. Let's suppose that the segment is only of length 2. Okay? And I take a sequence of size n, and I wrap it around, and I look at pairs. Now, how many pairs did I create that were not there before? Exactly one. The last one and the first one. So out of the n different pairs, there were actually in the sequence there were n minus 1 pairs. When I wrapped it cyclical, I created the nth pair. What's the chance that this extra pair will be the one that will give the large score? 1 over n. It's small.
Yeah, but for larger segments,
never happened. Log n over n. Still small. My segments are of length log n. I can show that segments which are much longer than log n, not
log n is the average, right?
No.
Log n is not the average expectation score is log n. I mean, basically.
Now what happened? The score decays very rapidly. So you can.
That's
really something you should discuss.
Let me try quickly to explain. The score decays very rapidly. Okay? The score decays very rapidly. The probability the score will be big decays very rapidly in the length. So we can first compute what is the probability that you will get a success for scores of segments of lengths, say 70 log n. And this probability is so small that we can simply ignore it completely from the beginning to the end. And thereafter, we just look at segments whose length is mostly 70 log n in the analysis. It doesn't mean that in the biology, we will not find something which is much longer than log n, because in the biology, it's not independent letters. So in the biologists don't want to take log n. But for the purpose of the analysis, we can say that really random segments should be of length log n. And one other thing you can do with it, which I said here, is another application of this to biology, is that you understand not only the length of the score, but you also understand in the random how would the random match look. So if you do a match in biology, you can look at your match. Is the frequency similar to P star? If it's not, it's another indication that this is not a random edge. Is the length of the segment similar to the one we get predicted from the mathematical theory? If it's not, it's another secondary indication that this is not a random event. So you get more information by looking at this.
Regarding your current slide, you said intuition about some approximation is such and such, and this statement is a little bit vague. Can you?
What statement?
Are you going to prove that the number of segments with score above 2i are distributed by Poisson?
I'm not going to prove. We proved. I'm not going to prove. We proved. This is a way. This is okay. This is a, okay. Let me put it. Okay. Let me make it precise. In the paper, where everything is proved, it is proved in this way. You actually prove that the number, as I said, the number of segment pairs ij with score bigger than y, when you take I and j up to this place and you make a wraparound cyclical transformation, is going to be in the limit when y becomes large, having a distribution, Poisson, with a parameter tk star. This is a mathematical theorem. I'm not going to prove this theorem here. Proving this theorem here will amount to doing all the technical stuff that I avoided by saying that these things which have only one angle aside are behaving like independent. This is the intuition, but also the way to actually justify the statement about the independence when you move by one. It is done in the framework of Poisson approximation. It gives you also a little bit more information, not only the probability that you get only one, but it gives you what way you get 2, 3, 4, and so on. It all goes immediately because it has this Poisson.
Well, it's crystal clear as soon as you prove it.
It's crystal clear as soon as we prove it, and you can prove it. Now, the proof. What is the proof? The proof amounts to saying what I just said, that when you make the angle by change angle by one, you can compute the probability that you will get a large match with angle shifted, assuming that you already got a large match without angle shifted. You just need to show this probability goes to zero. And it is a big mess. And so I don't want to do it here. It's way beyond, but I have the paper, so if you come to ask me, I will be able to do it.
There is something missing. It has to do with square root of t and so on.
I and j go from 1 to this number.
I see.
Okay? So I count the sum over indicator. I found a segment pair which had this go, and the I and j go up to here.
Okay.
And I wrap around, and we also, if you want, we can either take we don't say what the length of the segment pair is here, so we take a length which is around the length we expect to be, which is order of y, or log n if you think of this as n.
May I make a question which is either stupid or obvious or both?
There is no stupid question.
That very last formula looks like, in physics, what we do, there's a procedure called maximum entropy, in which you have an a priori probability distribution, P of A and B, and you make some measurements, and now you would like to modify that distribution in a minimum way, namely to keep the entropy maximum. And so the way to do that, when you measure F of A,
is to, yeah, this is a Gibbs measure, yeah. And this so is what I call Gibbs measure, yeah.
Yeah, a Gibbs measure.
Yeah, this is the maximum entropy principle, and this is what is behind what is going on here. What is behind what is going on here is the following. You are trying to get a large score F, but it costs you. So you're looking at minimizing the cost given a fixed reward, and you compute this e to the minus n of the relative entropy, k of the relative entropy. This is exactly the cost of creating a segment which has a joint distribution P star, and the value you get is the expected value of P star of F. So actually finding the parameter theta star is associated with the variational problem of, let's try to minimize the entropy, the relative entropy, subject to a given advantage in the expected value of the score F. We solve this infimum, we get that the answer is a measure P star and the parameter theta star. They all come from this maximum entropy. What maximum entropy does not provide you is a finer information. Finer information is this parameter k star and this Poisson distribution. The maximum entropy will only tell you the, what I said before, that the law will be p star, the segment will be of order log n times a constant, it will give you rough information, but it will not give you detailed information about limit law. In biology, you want a probability. For that, you have to work harder. Working harder amounts to saying that things are independent. Once they're independent, you're in good shape, plus the information from the wide sequence of K star, which is really complicated. It's like saying, in one sequence, you definitely have overlap. So you somehow say that you can actually measure the effective overlap. And this is delicate. And it's, I don't know how you can explain this in physics, because this is coming from a different theory. The theory that gives you theta star is called in probability large deviations theory. Large deviation theory is simply statistical mechanics, but done in mathematics. That clear. But this coming from a theory called fluctuation theory in probability. And this is not statistical mechanics. Maybe it's some other theory in physics, but it's not statistical mechanics. And it has the advantage of giving you more finer information, but the cost of making big formulas. Yes?
But back to the question, the fact that you can prove, if you have a perfect score, if you ship one and the next one will probably have a very small score. But that depends, that's where the large n comes in, right? You assume this sequence is n, so the match is log n, so that's still, so the error, there's some error which goes,
of course.
It goes like one over log n or one over n. Have estimation of that, and in terms of real sequence, which n is about, what, I don't know, 200, how big is that?
We did not try to compute the error. If we try to compute the error, it would be embarrassingly large. It will be for real, but it doesn't mean that the real error will be so large. It may mean that, you know, we, in the analysis for simplifying the mathematics, we add all sorts of things which are definitely ruining the life, like adding this extra term and all sorts of things. Now, my guess is that the error should behave like 1 over log n. But I'm not sure about that, because, but you can improve a little bit, because let's see, the error comes from, we have 1 over y in p of y, yes, so but the error actually, you know, even in compute p of y, as I said, p of y, when I start, I said p of y, this probability of just getting a fixed beginning point, one sequence, getting a big score, I said is constant times e to the minus theta star over times y. You can ask yourself, what does it mean? It's constant e to the minus theta star y times plus a correction term. The next correction term is probably 1 over y. If y is log n, if you already have a 1 over log n even here. Now these things we can actually write more complicated expression and fix it. So my guess is that you can get a much more complicated formula that will be more accurate. But it will be more complicated. Why do it? I mean, but I want to say something. The whole point in all this analysis, is the way I see it, is to get a nice, simple, relatively simple formula. Because in reality, the letters are not independent. This whole thing is used as a procedure. It's not. Nobody is claiming that in biology the letters are independent. This is ridiculous. So we're simply using it to create some kind of a formula that is easy to put in a computer, makes sense, and can help you, guide you whether you are having a good chance that this is really not coming from random effects or coming from random effects. So for that purpose, getting a much more complicated expression with a more correct second order term seems to be, to me at least, seems to be not worthwhile. But people are encouraged to follow.
Nevertheless. The theory is applied to the number of sequences larger than 2.
Yeah, I say it even here.
Do you know any attempts to use this theory for multiple lines?
You can use the same theory for 3 or 4 sequences. The answer will be the same. It will be n square will replace by n cube. And the condition will be, we can write the condition of match for 3 compared to all possible match of 2, all possible match of 1. This will give you the condition for the area where the theory will apply. Distribution will be Gamble, the same parameter K star, and so on. All this can be justified. It's the same proof. However, I want to mention that this is true under the following assumption. Number of sequence R is fixed. Length of sequence N goes to infinity. So if you apply to 30 sequence of length 30, it's very shaky. It's good for 3 sequences of length 400. that's fine. Four sequence of lengths 400. But once the numbers become close to each other, it's no longer correct. There is another thing which is important here to mention, which has to do with the biology. There are, in biology, insertion and deletions, which I conveniently completely ignored. Now, if you look at global alignment of a sequence, doing it without insertion and deletions is just going to be very bad as a procedure. If you look at local alignments, which is what we do here, there is a chance that locally there was no insertion or deletion. So you may catch quite nice things without insertion and deletions, which is why this theory can play a good role. But globally, it is not going to be good because of the gaps which I ignore. Now, the gaps are going to cause harm. Because even when you fix I and j, it's no longer a question of partial sums, but you actually have these gaps that can move you around, and you have to figure out what is the equivalent of K star. Now, there is work of Ralph and Terry here, and other people, who did a lot of progress in justifying the Gumbel distribution approximation for gapless alignment, because gapped alignment, and it seems that for gapped alignment, when the gap cost is relatively large, at least the distribution theory behaves the same, but there is no reason to expect the K star to be the same. It's not the same. It's coming from different, there are these different effects of all these possible gaps to open and close that complicate the story. And we don't currently don't know how to, mathematically, how to compute the effective K star. I mean, how to, not heuristically, but actually prove the effective K star. It's extremely complicated matter. And there are some indications in work of Sigmund and Yakir that it's even not correct, that it's not exactly Poisson, that there are extra clumping effects. So the Poisson distribution is no longer even in the limit correct. It's just first order correct. So there is another effect that is never disappearing, but maybe a little bit smaller. So it's a little bit of a mess. Okay, so I wanted to... Originally, I planned to mention something about matching on structures, but I'm no longer so sure that we did not exhaust ourselves in a joint effort.
I mean, the problem is I don't know if we can get through in the afternoon. Huh? Can we leave the bag in here in the afternoon?
I can talk forever, but you have to be politely sitting here, and maybe some people want to leave at some point.
Probably a good idea. So then, let's say we meet here at 2:00, and
yes, there is a seminar by Von Klitzing.
Oh, right, that's 2:00 in the afternoon. Yeah. What should we do?
No, it's a 2.
No, it's a 2.
It's a strong competition.
Maybe 4:00 if people want to.
Yeah, 4:00, whoever is interested.
Okay. What will it be about? So can you just examine
it? So far I talked, let me say 5 more minutes what it's going to be about, but I will not answer questions, so this will be, okay. So far I talked about matching in sequences. Now there is now in biology, this is technology of X-ray in physics, is very old, but they took some, now it's, I was told, much more common to get a protein with X-rays. Picture, so you have the actual three-dimensional structure, and when you look at the three-dimensional structure, everyone knows that although this primary sequence represent pairs of amino acids which are close together, these are actually folded in space. That's why physicists are very interested in the inverse folding problem. And when they fold in space, some pieces which are far away on the primary sequence come together to the neighborhood of somebody else. So you have a picture of, you have a picture in space which looks like a line you have space, three-dimensional, and you have a noodle, intersect itself. So now a neighborhood of this point will be this piece. And if you look at it on the primary sequence, it contains this segment, it contains also this segment, and these two segments are pretty far from each other. So when you do matching, if you are looking for structural similarity, you probably should do it based on the three-dimensional structure. So previously, people were always doing matching based on sequences because they had the sequences, they did not have the structure, so how can you match stuff you don't know? But now that there are more structures, it suggests that you may want to study local extremes in a structure, or you may want to study the dependence or similarity of two pieces in two different structures. So now you know the actual position of the points. So now you have not only letters arranged in a sequence, but bunch of letters or numbers also with positions, and you want to look at physical neighborhoods and match them. So it will be similar theory, but it will be more complicated. And I can go on. And then you have to also make some model in, first of all, you have to figure out what is going to be the good statistic to do. So how do you match? And you also have to have some model about what is the law of the position. Not only what are the law of the letters, but what is the law of the position. And we had few models. We had models on graphs, models on trees, models on the unit cube, all sorts of models. Some of them you can analyze, some you cannot.
Okay, well, let's leave it at that. Thank you. As I already said, Amir will be around till tomorrow afternoon. I guess I will come over with me as a colleague talk to him.